All right, I'm going to have Dr. Griggs open in prayer.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift of Sandy, the message she has for us today. Help us to look on this positively, negatively, and realize that we're really not made for this life. We're made for something beyond this life. And thank you, Lord, for the gift of Jesus Christ and his sacrifice for us so we might be with you for eternity. In Christ's name we ask this. Amen.
Amen. All right. Just out of curiosity, do you have any math science people here? Like real math science people? Anybody? Nobody? Math science. Anybody math science-y? Has anybody ever heard of, definitely not him. Well, not him. Something called the Mandelbrot paradox. You know what it is?
I used to know.
Used to know. Okay. We've done house cleaning since then. So it's this idea that, you know, if you measure the coastline of England using kilometers, we can say how many kilometers long it is. But the more you reduce the increment, the larger the number gets. And so essentially you can always infinitely reduce the increment that you're using to measure something. So in a sense, like practically speaking, although you can measure it, if you use an increment that's too small, you essentially can keep shrinking down, 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 down. Does that make sense? So kind of an end of life, you have to choose your area of resolution. You can get questions that are so specific that it's a little bit like getting down to a nanometer. And so I can't, you know, you can't talk about this topic. You have to talk about it in somewhat of a general way. There's always greater and greater and greater specifics that you might need to resort to looking at and including in your decision-making matrix. So what I'm trying to do is choose a way to look at this that gives us the greatest amount of ability to make decisions in whatever situation we happen to find ourselves in. So the most important thing to say at the very beginning is this topic is on food and water at the end of life. So that phrase at the end of life is really important because I'm not talking about somebody that's in ICU that may or may not be at the end of life. And I can just think of Bob Coates a few years ago who fell, broke his neck, they fixed it, and then he ended up with a lot of like ongoing problems. And he ended up in ICU for months and then on a respirator for the better part of a year. So that's not what I'm talking about, because for Bob, and even to some extent I would say for Dwayne, if the reason that they're in ICU is not specifically because they're dying, it may be because they had an incident like a heart attack or a stroke, where possibly you're going to be able to pull them back, and we have the technology to do that. But when we've got somebody that has cancer or has some underlying pathological process that's making the overwhelming likelihood that they're dying, that's who we're talking about when we talk about whether or not we use food and water to help them. Is that a beneficial thing to do? Are we kind of clear about that? Go ahead.
Does hospice have there are sort of a time frame that's in your head when you say end of life, a week?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. Yeah. So this is also the tricky thing. How do you know, you know, where you're at on this continuum that's kind of moving towards end of life? And I think I mentioned last week, one of the things that I told Janet with her elderly father is, well, you know, when I look at him, he could be 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years away from dying. And what I meant by that is he was old. He was very frail, but he didn't have cancer. He didn't have anything that was actively killing him. He had some kidney impairment. He had probably some scarring in his lungs and some, you know, he had a lot of issues that were going on. And so for him, what I meant by 3 days is if he got the flu, probably 3 days. If he stayed healthy and didn't even get a cold, probably 3 years. Does that make sense? So, some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about really is kind of looking at like the last week of life. And so as you're moving, and so again, let me just draw a picture of kind of who I have in my mind when I'm thinking about this. Thinking about somebody who's quite elderly, and over months, their interest in food and water has just gradually been declining. That's just a normal, that's a normal thing that happens. But I might also be talking about somebody who's got cancer, and they're growing thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner, and their interest in food and water has just declined. So what's common for both of these populations is that the person's own interest in eating and drinking has declined significantly. So, and I think, you know, what sparks a lot of the heated concern around this topic comes from this place of compassion, this desire to see that our loved ones are comfortable, that they're well cared for, that they're not suffering unnecessarily. So, what I'm really wanting to do is make a case to you for why the place of, I would say, of compassionate care has come to involve not providing food and water at the end of life. And that, in the years that I've done hospice and palliative care, I would say this particular topic is the most incendiary. And yet, it's the topic I've, in fact, the lecture that I'm giving you, I've actually never seen written anywhere. Just putting the math to why we don't need to do this. And I'm not sure why it is, because I think I can just say, when I talked to one of the men in our congregation whose wife died of cancer, felt enormous guilt at the end, because he was concerned that his wife's family felt like he'd starved her to death. So I'll address why he didn't do that in just a minute. So let's talk about the process of dying. How do we sort of know that's happening? One of the things that we typically see is growing weakness, loss of appetite, increased drowsiness, shortening of attention span, difficulty processing information. We also see circulatory changes. You might start to see, like, this is interesting. One of the things, and I hope this doesn't apply to anybody in this room, but when you see those toenails that are really thick and really hardened, that's actually already impaired circulation to the lower extremities. Now, that doesn't mean they're dying. I'm just saying that over a long period of time, you get the heart stops necessarily trying to get to places where a rescue is not likely to happen. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay. And the closer you get towards the heart actually stopping, and really, we use, in hospice and palliative care, we use the heart stopping as our index of whether or not death has happened. Clearly, if you're in ICU, that's not the index, because we can shock you, we can intubate you, we can keep you going on for a lot longer. But outside of the hospital, outside of a intensive rescue situation, the heart stopping is what we use as our indication of whether or not someone's dying. But other things that we see is we see changes in breathing pattern, and we see decreased urine production. So again, as you're watching somebody and you're wondering, is it happening? And as a woman who's had three children, I can tell you there's a part of this that's a little bit like, when is the baby going to come? Except that when is a baby going to come falls within about a 4-week range, generally speaking, 4 to 6 weeks. Whereas death and dying can be a whole lot longer, and it's the same thing of this expectancy of, do we take that trip? Can we use our tickets and go to New York, or is mom going to die? So some of the things that you look for, the things that I just said, but again, even if you're looking at changes in mentation, interest in food and water, increased drowsiness, we're still in the time frame of potentially days, weeks, months. Once you get to real genuine circulatory changes and changes in respiration, now we're talking about days to hours. Does that make sense? Okay. So part of the reason that food and water are so sensitive to people is because these are forms of communion. They're ways that we connect with each other. It's how you show your love for someone. We drink wine, we break bread, we even do it. I mean, it's woven into our faith. It's woven into, for women, for our ideas of what it means to be a mother, to take care of somebody. It's to cook for them and to feed for them, to feed them. So, and families often worry that if their loved one isn't eating or drinking, that's the reason that they're dying. And it really does matter which way you look at this. If somebody is starving themselves to death, that looks very different from somebody who's dying and as a result, their appetite is changing. Are you guys, that's pretty clear. You can conjure up a picture of what somebody who's starving to death, either voluntarily or involuntarily, like you could look at anorexia or you could look at somebody, say, in a concentration camp. They're not the same thing. Because if somebody has anorexia, if somebody's in a concentration camp, if you give them food and water, they are going to return to health. If somebody is dying from some pathology that's underneath, that's robbing them of their health, giving them food and water is not going to pull them back from the brink of death. Still doesn't answer the question whether or not it might be the compassionate or humane thing to do. So the case that I'm making is that generally speaking, it's not the humane thing to do. And we've learned that really through trial and error because our healthcare system is designed to financially reward care providers when they actually do something. So we're incentivized to do something, right? You don't get any money if you don't do anything. So for a long time, we've tried doing something when people are dying to see whether or not it helps. Okay. So let me just back up and I'm going to talk about nutrition. Let's talk about when somebody's at the end of life. And here I'm going to define it as they're somewhere in that last 6 months. Maybe they're on hospice, maybe they're not. When would the benefits of nutrition outweigh the risks? Well, let's say you've got somebody that's got, let's say esophageal cancer, right? That's a cancer that's going to impair your ability because of the tumor growth. You might not be able to eat. But really, other than that, your heart's in good shape, your liver's in good shape, your kidney's still functioning, and maybe you've got a kid that's a junior in high school or a senior in high school, and there's no reason you shouldn't be able to live 6 more months or even another year. Might that be the kind of place where we'd want to put in a feeding tube? Absolutely, yes. Sure. What about if you're in an ICU and fighting for your life takes a lot of energy? And we think there's a chance that, we think there's a at least enough of a fighting chance of you coming back that we want to give you the benefit of nutrition. Yes, of course, that's another place where we would want to do it. What about if you're absolutely dying. You've got lung cancer. But, you know, you're still walking around. Maybe you're still going to the grocery store. You get a cart. You're pushing it. You go home. You wipe your nose. Whoops, somebody gave you the flu. You know, when they were pushing the cart, you came home. Now you're throwing up. Now, that throwing up is going to make you really sick really fast because you're already undernourished, maybe a little underhydrated. And potentially, if we don't do anything, might kill you pretty quickly. But again, if it weren't for the fact that you just got some viral illness that's now making you throw up, you might still reasonably have months. So that's another situation where, yes, help them get through this particular crisis. 'Cause part of what we're always wanting to do is give people the maximum amount of time to do the work that they need to do to end their life. I mean, ending your life, most people want to do that well. They want to reconcile with family. They want to say, I love you and I'm sorry. And not everybody is willing to do that at the moment they get the diagnosis. Some people aren't really willing to do it until they get truly frightened. And maybe it's that viral illness where they're throwing up and now they really are feeling their mortality. And an extra month might really make a difference in their opportunity to mend the fence with a child or with a parent. So another instance might be, And this is kind of a tricky one. What if you have a loved one who's pretty immobile, they're in bed, and they're not really eating and drinking very well, and they've developed a pressure sore? Wow, super painful. I mean, it is physically painful, but as a loved one, that is really excruciating to see this big thing open up on the backside of your loved one. Is nutrition going to help? The answer is maybe. Maybe. And you really are going to have to weigh it out. How close are they to dying? If they're within 5 or 6 days of dying, it wouldn't matter if you put the food and hydration in. The body is still not going to expend the energy to repair that tissue. Does that make sense to you guys? So really it comes down to making the judgment call about the food and water. If they've got something that's happening, you have to ask yourself the question, if I make food and water available, will the body still expend the energy to fix the problem? Does that make sense? Okay, so what are some of the burdens that, the risks that happened when we start putting, and here I'm talking about food into somebody, particularly artificial food, meaning we're going to put an NG tube in, we're just going to bypass your effort to eat. We're going to put that tube in through your nose, go down into your stomach, or we're going to implant it surgically and we're going to give you food. Okay, so now you've made food available. But are you absolutely sure that because it's expensive. Even if you're putting in pretty much digested food, I mean, if it's in a liquid form, if it can go through the tube, a lot of the work of breaking that stuff down into the form that the body's going to use it has already been done. But there's still a lot of work that has to be done in order to get it out of your GI system, into your circulatory system, and then sent all over the body, taken up by the cells, and then the cells themselves have to be able to use that energy to maintain cellular function. So there's right? Just making it available doesn't mean that the body's actually going to use it. So what happens if we actually put the food in, we put the food in place? And the body is a little indifferent about whether or not it's going to use it. So that's where we start to see nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, aspiration. And all of these are horrific to watch in your loved one. So let's say they're starting, you know, you put it in there and now, the food kind of sits in the stomach. Now you've got nausea. Okay, let's add some extra medication to mitigate the nausea, right? Or then, if it sits there in the stomach, what can also happen is the stomach sits there and feels kind of meh about it. Maybe it'll throw it up, but maybe it'll just dump it. Maybe it'll just open up that sphincter and push it through the small intestines and try to get it out that way. Well, that's diarrhea. And that's really painful, unpleasant, difficult when someone's dying because you got to get people in there. And you got to remember that in Austin, there is one inpatient hospice. The rest are nursing homes or people's homes. So this is happening in your home. And now, how do you change the bed when someone's got diarrhea? And again, I would advocate it if on the back end of the diarrhea episode, we were going to gain health. We were going to see an improved condition. But if all we've done is place an unfair burden on the body, yes?
How often in one of these cases that you described do the people that are sick or dying want food?
Almost, that's the interesting thing, rarely. Yeah, and that's because their interest is actually declining. And I think it's really God's blessing that people become less interested in food and water. Dying is not something, for the most part, unless you get hit by a car or you have a massive heart attack or stroke, for the most part, the body winds down somewhat slowly. It's the living that are saying, mom, eat something, mom, drink something. And even people who are dying sometimes still want to please you. So in hospice, what we do is we defer to the patient. If the patient says, I want some ice cream, give them some ice cream. If they say they want a bite of a hamburger, they can have a bite of a hamburger. I have taken entire meals up to people because that's what they wanted, knowing that they might only smell it. They might only look at it. They might only take one bite. It's still okay. It's not the quantity. It's not even whether or not they actually touched it or swallowed it. You still have that act of caring and communion surrounding food if they said they want it and you brought it and then they couldn't eat it. Does that make sense? So we're changing our expectation about what the outcome looks like.
Sandy, can I just add something?
Yes.
Something that I've seen in my life and just being around is when somebody is in a hospital or, you know, dying type situation and their body is not really able to take food in, the loved one who wants to, who thinks the fix is to feed that person, will blame the caregiver, whether it's a hospital or hospice, they're starving my grandmother to death and all that. And
right.
That's not, but it's hard to kind of explain that. You know, the body really can't take it.
Well, and that's why as a hospice worker, sometimes you'll go in and you'll provide oral care and there's scrambled eggs and pancakes and all kinds of stuff that, you know, has gotten chipmunked away in the person's mouth. Yeah, it's really difficult. The other thing that's is like when you're talking about cancer is like this greedy little monger that's going to queue up in the Luby's cafeteria line before any of the rest of your cellular processes. And so that's why people who are dying of cancer, they're eating and they're getting skinnier and skinnier and skinnier. It's called cachexia. And it's because the malignant cells are reproducing at a much faster rate than any of the rest of the cells. So they're queuing up in line first and they're getting all the nutrition. And so they're growing and growing and growing. And, none of the cells that we would normally associate with health and welfare are getting the nourishment. Does that make sense? Okay.
Little cells cutting to the front of the line.
Yeah, somebody. Okay, so, all right, one of the things that I want to talk about, this is actually a quote. Don't want to say it came out of Focus on the Family, but it might have, and I'm sorry that I don't know that. Came back during the culture wars in the 80s when Terri Schiavo's family was fighting over whether or not to disconnect the feeding tube. And that's actually a whole nother conversation, and that's kind of like the Mandelbrot equation. I'm not talking about her situation because there's a lot more involved. But this was something that was put in print. As a person dies from dehydration, his or her mouth dries out and becomes caked or coated with thick material. Lips become parched and cracked. The tongue swells and could crack. Eyes recede back into their orbits. Cheeks become hollow. The lining of the nose might crack and cause the nose to bleed. The skin begins to hang loose on the body and becomes dry and scaly. Urine would become highly concentrated, leading to burning of the bladder. Lining of the stomach dries out, likely causing the person to experience dry heaves and vomiting. Temperature becomes very high. Brain cells dry out, causing convulsions. The respiratory tract dries out, causing thick secretions that could plug the lungs and cause death. At some point, the person's major organs, including the lungs, heart, and brain, give out, and death occurs. Who wants their family to die like that? Right? No one. I have taken care of hundreds of people, and I've never seen anybody die like that. Not remotely. When do we see that? Okay, we see that if you're stranded on the ocean, and you're waiting for a rescue, and you have no water to drink. Right? We see that if you got lost in Big Bend in July because you were silly enough to go there in July. No. Like, right? We see that when a normal person is out, their body is functional, and now they don't have access to the water that they need to keep their brains and their muscles and their internal organs going. If somebody's mouth is black at the end of life because they're dying, it's because somebody didn't provide oral care. It's not a normal thing that happens. And again, I've only seen it when there was a lack of appropriate care. Okay. So one of the things, let's do this next. I'm going to actually probably need a couple of volunteers. Lynn, can I get you two? All right. Whoops. Oh, okay. I'll need that in a minute, but that's leaking. Okay. All right, let me ask you this. how many, sorry, guys, you look very nice in your jacket there. Yes, style show. How many liters of water are there in the human body? This is where the math comes in, a really important concept.
Five or so.
Five or so. Anybody have any other thoughts? Don't use your phone, by the way, to look it up. That would be considered cheating. No, can't convert it to gallons. It's harder, actually, if we did it to gallons. So I just want you to know, I've taught this class at Austin Community College. I teach it for paramedics. I've taught it for nursing students. No one has ever even come close to getting the answer right. So that's how counterintuitive it is, even though how many of you guys probably have heard that you're made up of 50% water? Anybody know that? Okay. All right, so let's just convert you. Let's just randomly say most of us don't weigh 100 kilos. Easier to do kilos. Let's just say you weighed 100 kilos, which would be more than 200 pounds. And if 50% of you is water, a kilogram equals a liter. How many liters of water is in the human body now?
50.
Okay. So, it's going to get long, so you're going to have to help in the middle. So, we don't have to do the math. This is like the average American female, the average American male, how much they weigh, determining how many liters of water they are. Okay. So, the average, if we averaged males and females' weight together, we'd come up with 45 liters of water in the human body. All right. 20% of this is extracellular. So what does that mean? It means it's outside your cells. So your brain has 100 trillion cells, just so you guys get the math. We're talking about mind-boggling numbers of cells in the body. So the body holds the largest reserve of the water, so 20% of it is outside the cells. All right? So of that 20%, 15% outside your circulatory system. So your circulatory system, which is, that's our bloodstream, right? That's got the smallest amount. And can you go back that way? And then Nathan, I'm going to have you. Sorry. Well, I'm going to have you duck under. Keep coming. Let's see. Why don't I get you all the way out here? I might need somebody in the middle, or maybe it'll be me. See how this is what 45 liters of water looks like. Yeah, I think we're not going to quite. All right, so here we go. Can I get somebody to maybe hold up this end, and I'll just give a little talk here. All right. It's a lot of water inside the human body. All right. So 5% is actually blood. So that's about 4 liters, right? So I want you to think about this. And normally, water likes to stay... water basically is attracted to particles. Call that solute. So water is not staying equally distributed across the inside of the cell, the outside of the cell, and then inside the circulatory system. Those are the three main compartments, right? It's not equally distributed, or we would see this 45 liters being one-third blood, one-third cells, and one-third outside the cells. We don't see that. The vast majority of it is inside the cells, and it's because our cells are full of objects, right? Nucleus, mitochondria, RNA, DNA, Golgi apparatus, sodium, potassium, phosphate. So the cells are richer in the kinds of things that hang on to water. And this becomes important as we dehydrate. So let's think about what these 4 liters, they're in red because it's the blood, are doing. So let me see what it says. 300 trillion capillaries. That's how, you can go back, sorry. 300 trillion capillaries are inside the human body, which amounts to 60,000 miles of vasculature in each of our bodies, which is enough to go around the world twice. Your heart's doing that. Your heart is pumping 4 liters through all of that. Can you see how expensive that is? You can also see that 4 liters cannot be in 60,000 miles of vasculature all the time, in all places at all times. Correct? That'd be impossible. So basically, our body makes the decision about where to send oxygen-rich blood based on oxygen concentrations falling. So whenever the cells in a region start to need oxygen, the pH changes, the capillaries open up, and oxygen-rich blood comes through, delivers oxygen, picks up the garbage waste. Does this make sense to you guys? All right. So now I want you to think about a dying person. Any thoughts on whether or not their heart's going to be as strong as yours or mine? Probably not. So the heart has a hard time continuing to deliver oxygen, nutrients, and waste removal to all 60,000 miles of vasculature in the body. So that's why we start to see these changes in circulation, particularly in the lower extremities, where if you've ever had anybody dying in hospice, the first thing they do come in, the nurse picks up that bed cover and puts her fingers on the foot to see if you can feel that pedal pulse, the pulse down there. Once you're stopped, you don't feel that pedal pulse anymore. It's a pretty good indication that the heart's not strong enough to deliver oxygen and nutrients way down south or remove waste. So then you start to see the modeling changes. Cells don't get the oxygen that they need. There's a buildup of waste material. The cells start to explode. That's when you see, it's called modeling, this kind of like grayish cast that you're seeing in the lower extremities. But guess what's happening? Every time cells become sufficiently impaired in their local environment due to a lack of oxygen and a buildup of waste products, these cells rupture and they release their water. So now you're actually freeing up water that the vasculature can essentially tax, because remember, this is what the heart and the body really cares about. I mean, when it comes to end of life, it cares about all of it. But essentially, if this is kind of like the spending capital, this is about the oxygen delivery and waste removal. As your kidney function drops, as your ability to ingest food and water declines, you might see the amount of water in this compartment start to fall. As it falls, what is happening to the concentration of the stuff inside your arteries and your veins? It's going to go up. So as it rises, the concentration now is higher inside your vessels than it is inside the cells. So what's going to happen to the fluid gradient? It shifts. So now, essentially, this compartment's developed the ability to tax the rest of it, right? To draw water. So really, when someone's dying, we have deep reserves of water. Now, this is not deep reserves of water if you're out on the Pacific Ocean stranded and you're hoping to survive it. You're going to go through this pretty quickly. But if you're talking about somebody whose heart is pumping slower or less effectively, blood flow to the kidneys is now reduced, so we're not making a lot of urine. Respirations become more erratic, sometimes a lot slower, maybe sometimes faster. The number of cells in the body, they say, is 37 trillion cells. That's an awful lot that the body is trying to keep supplied. And as you see when someone's dying, the body starts to make strategic decisions about what to provide, let's call them social services too. Social services being oxygen and waste removal. So what does the body care about? Okay, well, the heart continues to try to actually accomplish this fairly small circuit, which is heart, lung, brain. Heart, lung, brain. Which is why we always tell you when your loved one's dying, continue to talk to them. Continue to touch them, to tell them that you love them. Because we don't actually know what somebody is hearing at the end of their life, especially once they're no longer conscious. But God made us for attachment. And he made us to respond to the signals of attachment, not just through voice, but through touch and through warmth. So as long as this is happening, there's still the opportunity for connecting with your loved one. All right, I guess we can roll this up. So we've only got a few more minutes. Does anybody have any questions or hard cases they would like to bring up?
So, Sandy, are we talking about IV fluids or trying to get someone to swallow a drink? Or
okay, here I was when I say artificial, I'm meaning IV fluids. As long as somebody is expressing thirst, like a lot of times what we do in hospice is they make those little pink sponges, or sometimes they're yellow, and you dip them in water, and you can use them to clean, and it moistens the mouth. If somebody is saying, I'm thirsty, we give them water. Now, even at this point, there's like 60 muscles that are involved in an effective swallow. So as you die, these muscles, or as you get weaker and weaker, these muscles also stop to function adequately. So now what are we at risk of?
Aspiration.
So if we're going to balance the risk of aspiration against someone expressing a desire to have a bite of ice cream or a swallow of water, what do we choose? Give it to them. Yeah. And again, this is some place where you have to kind of tread lightly and let people feel their way towards a decision. If somebody feels really passionately that dad should not have that bite of ice cream because he's diabetic. I know, but believe it, you know, it happens. Do we really have a need to override them? You know, not necessarily, because sometimes you might be causing more injury inside of the family. And so you let people do. You let people make the decisions that they need to make. If they're willing and open for advice and counsel, then you do get to speak into their lives. And I will say, just talking to people about the body's reserves and the body's ability to tap into the amount of fluid that it needs. Because remember, at this point, we're talking about the amount of fluid that the body needs in order to accomplish dying, right? We're not going to return them to health. Even if we put that, because what are we going to do if we put that IV in there? Now we've put this incredible burden on the heart to have to pump the extra fluid. And guess where in your body would be the body system that's the most susceptible to experiencing problems if there's too much fluid on board? Any ideas? Who said lungs? Yes, lungs. So, all right, so now if we have too much fluid on board and the lungs are experiencing what we call fluid volume overload, that's when it starts to seep out of the capillary system, and that's when you start to hear the gurgling, the coughing, the struggling to breathe. And that, if you've ever seen fluid volume overload and someone who's dying, it's really not something that I would want to do to somebody. But we did it to a lot of people, thinking that by offering them hydration at the end of life, we were preventing them from experiencing this calamity called dehydration. There is some research that shows that at the end of life, that the dehydration that is associated with the process of dying causes the release of endorphins. So there's essentially no credible evidence that the normal physiologic dehydration at the end of life causing pain and discomfort to a loved one is pretty much non-existent. Now, going back to Mandelbrot's equation or the Mandelbrot's paradox, you might have a specific situation with your loved one where perhaps food and water might be warranted. And I would take you back to what I said last week. Get help. Ask for advice. And I think you mentioned this last week, that sometimes it's the most conservative person in the family that holds the greatest power. And I would say, even medically speaking, that's kind of the case. If there is one person in the group that wants to intervene, the system is canted, generally speaking, in favor of intervention, especially where no one's been given the legal authority to make a decision. Does anybody have any questions or observations?
Yeah,
I mean, I know my father-in-law was passing. He seemed very comfortable.
Yeah.
In other words, so my question is then, as a general rule, how reliable is the person's appearance of being comfortable with this? If they feel comfortable and look comfortable and express comfortable, aren't they comfortable?
I think they're comfortable. Okay. I mean, I will say this. On the other side, we say if somebody gets to the, they've been in pain, they have some underlying pathologic process that has caused them to have pain that's needed to be treated, and now they're no longer able to talk, they're comatose. Would we assume that if they grimace when you turn them, that they're still in pain, even though they can't say they're in pain? Right. We would assume. So basically, we do sort of assume that our bodies are wired to reflect the way that we feel. And if somebody is making a painful face, they're probably in pain. If somebody's looking pretty placid, pretty comfortable, they're probably pretty comfortable. Because again, I'm talking about if the heart is still beating, it's bothering to perfuse the brain. Maybe not the outer cortex, but at least on like that level of keeping your heart going, keeping your blood pressure calibrated, keeping your attachment system is in the inside of your brain, right? If all of that is still going, then I think we can rely upon, you know, what the face is saying or what somebody is saying. And I think the other thing that's interesting is normally when somebody gets, especially we're talking about an older person, they're getting towards the end of their life, they're less and less thirsty. You have to force them to want to drink. Mom, you got to drink something. You got to drink something. They're not walking around suffering, feeling like, I'm feeling very parched. Could you just get me my water? Right. So, good point. I think yes.
How specific, when we're planning for ourselves in these power of attorneys and medical directives, it's probably important.
I think
it would be nice to have a really understand, like, how specific do we make?
That's these? Mandelbrot's paradox.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think you actually do, because, and I would take you back to Bob Coates. You know, Bob was on a respirator for a year. He had a feeding tube. He had a really long recovery. But his heart was in pretty good shape. His kidneys were functioning. And, you know, just as a provider, as somebody who's taking care of the dying, there were times I thought Bob might have died. But he didn't. And he kept looking to me like somebody that was going to be able to come back. So, and he is, you know, he's had years now of relatively good health. You know, and I think another remarkable recovery is Dwayne. So that's why I think it's actually, we need principles. We don't need like a micro checklist about what to do at what point. You know,
people change their minds.
Yes.
When we did our attorney, and Candace, obviously next week may have a different, but he said, look, give this to the person in your life you trust. Tell everybody that they have the legal authority to do anything and that they know your wishes.
Right.
If they don't know your wishes, tell them your wishes or write them down for them.
Right.
But don't do it for the person who has the attorney.
Right.
And he also said, don't ever give that to a doctor or hospital.
That's serious. Well, I mean,
I don't know that I agree with that, but that's what he said.
I agree with it. I think it's you do those for the person that is going to be the agent, so they know. But you also do it for the other relatives, because then it helps the person that has it justify, this is what mom and dad wanted, or
right.
wanted, whereas before it could be, well, no, I heard him say this.
Right.
I heard him say this. It's written.
Well, and out of love and compassion for the person who is your medical power of attorney for health care, it only takes one naysayer to make that person who made the decisions really struggle with the aftermath of the decisions that they made. So I think the more transparent we are about the general principles of what we want, that we've communicated them with the understanding that we've got Mandelbrot's paradox here, that they may always come up against some particular way of looking at this that required a resolution level that was beyond anything that you talked about. So that's where you go back to. So let me just, before I'll close, there was a situation, and I won't name names, in our church of somebody who was dying of cancer, and one person had the power of attorney, but there was another, I would say, big player who was very vocal, who did not have power of attorney. All the doctors, the nurses, the oncologists, everybody felt like there was no turning this particular cancer around. And this was somebody who had a feeding tube. They had tried putting the artificial sustenance in there, and just because you put it in there, as I told you, doesn't mean the body's going to use it. So the consensus on the medical side and with the power of attorney for healthcare was that they weren't going to be able to cure this cancer. But if you've got somebody over there who's very vocal, and they can sound very virtuous too, about, I want them to be comfortable, I want to rescue them, we believe that there's healing, we believe it can be nutrition, we believe. It's unbelievable the damage that that can cause in a situation. And so I'll just close on this, that there's this thing in psychiatry called secondary gain that sometimes you have to be cautious of. And that's where somebody is getting some benefit for the position that they're advocating for. And so whether it's that they were experiencing some guilt in the relationship, and if I advocate for more, I feel better about us. It's a display of my love for this other person. It's going to make whatever goes down easier for me. It's kind of tends to be all about the self. So I guess going back, it's very complicated. Families are very complicated in these situations. Really, really, really complicated. And, you know, I think when at all possible for us as a church, the thing that makes sense, is to support the person that has medical power of attorney for healthcare, because that was who was entrusted to make the decisions by the person who was dying. And that we should be canted in the direction of giving them our support. Not that we don't support others, but we shouldn't be supporting others at the expense of the person who's been tasked with making the decisions. Does that make sense? Thank you guys for your attention. I'm sorry we went over a little bit.